atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're here. We have a big show coming your way this hour. We're going to be joined by Kurt Volker, the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, former United States special representative for Ukraine negotiations. Maybe he'll get that job again. I know Trump's looking to hire somebody. And Teresa Payton served as the first female chief information officer for the White House during the President Bush's administration, CEO and founder of Fortress Solutions. And we're going to talk about cybersecurity and what the heck is going on now with China and what they're doing at a dizzying rate right now and how to preserve our stuff and what Elon Musk can do for Trump and this administration too, especially with his knowledge of AI. Before we get to Kurt, let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And there's real concern today that following that approval from the Americans allowing the Ukrainians to launch long-range missiles into Russian territory, that there will be further Russian retaliation. We heard air raid sirens earlier today in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, and the U.S. Embassy here in this population center of about 4 million people issued a rare alert this morning.
Escalation. The Biden administration releases restrictions on mines and missiles. Russia threatens nuclear war, cuts underwater cables to NATO nations, arms Houthis, Hezbollah, and allies with Iran. The world is on fire. What Trump can do in the wings while he waits to take over.
Number two.
Elections have consequences, but what we can do is make sure that we are doing our part to protect our residents in every possible way, that we are not cooperating with those efforts that actually threaten the safety of everyone.
That is Mayor Michelle Wu of Boston. Illegal immigration removal plans begin to take shape, and insane Democratic opposition digs in. They seem to care more about their criminal aliens than their legal citizens. Don't worry, Tom Homan is on the job.
Number one.
President-elect has made more selections. He's chosen Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick as his commerce secretary, Dr. Mehmet Oz to run Medicare and Medicaid, and wrestling executive and former administrator of the Small Business Administration in the first term, Linda McMahon. She's Trump's education secretary nominee.
And that is Rich Edson talking about the expanding Trump team. It looks like they had two more major names, as you just heard. Sean Duffy, of course, too. His nominees start massive preparation for what will be explosive and consequential nominee hearings, which will start the first week in January. With me right now is Ambassador Kurt Volker. Ambassador, the Russians are really picking up the pace, and the Ukrainians now have permission to get the ATACMS into Russian territory, as well as they're finally getting mines to stop the Russian advancement. What's your take on how this war is going?
Well, I think the Russians right now are in an effort to grab as much as they can. They know Trump's coming into office. They know their own military is in a relatively weak position. So they expect that there's going to be some kind of settlement next year, and they just want to grab what they can right now. The Biden administration, by making some of these decisions, they're really exposing some of the weak position that they were in before this. There was no reason to invent this restriction on the long-range use of weapons, something they created. Now that they're undoing it, they're finding it embarrassing, and they're giving the Russians a talking point.
Ambassador, I trust your contacts as much as anything, but I saw a Bloomberg report that said that the U.S. is still telling the U.K. and other NATO allies, keep your restrictions on your long-term missiles. Is that true?
I saw that. I heard that from someone in the UK yesterday. I haven't verified it. There's a reason why they would do that. Not a good reason, mind you, but there is a reason, which is they would feel they would have more control over target selection if it's the actual U.S.-provided weapons rather than ones that others are providing. But I suspect this will get changed. It was illogical to put this restriction on long-range in place to begin with. And now that they're lifting it, it's illogical to say, well, you can use ours, but you can't use the British.
So the other thing that I understand is Zelensky was saying they've only got a small portion of what's been pledged from the U.S. and that what Congress has already green-lighted to go over there. I mean,
exactly.
What can you tell us about that?
So as you remember, earlier this year, President Trump stood beside Mike Johnson and said he's doing a great job as Johnson was getting the Congress to approve this additional $61 billion for Ukraine. So this was done back in March, I believe. It went very slowly. Things were not moving as quickly as they should. We ended up in the autumn with a pile of money still unspent. And so now the Biden administration is trying to do everything possible to push that out the door. Again, like so many other things, should have been done long ago.
So here is President Zelensky sitting down with Trey Yingst yesterday. And here's what he says he hopes can happen with Trump. Cut 17.
Are you hopeful that President-elect Trump will be able to influence Putin to end the war?
It will be not simple. But I think if to use all the issues what the United States has, yes, he can. Because he is much more stronger than Putin. He's stronger. United States stronger. Economy stronger. You know, money, big money. United States has big, very big influence.
So your thoughts, I know he's a politician too. So what do you think he's really thinking?
Well, I think what he's thinking is that more of the same from the Biden administration, if that were to continue into the Harris administration, it would be a slow death for Ukraine. Never enough resolve, restrictions on everything that they do, no real show of strength. So he knew that was going to be a losing proposition. He is hopeful that Trump will restore a position of strength, and that's the way to get peace. Trump keeps saying he wants to bring peace, wants to end this war, needs to be a fair peace, would never have happened if he was president. Those are all signs that he is thinking that you need to restore strength as well. So that's what Zelensky is playing to.
So the Russians, in return, say that they're going to change their threshold for how they're going to use tactical nuclear weapons, and they pretend to sign this big doctrine, and they say we have escalated by lifting restrictions, as if we don't realize that adding 10 to 12,000 and potentially 100,000 more North Korean troops had everything to do with escalation.
Right. Brian, if I'm not mistaken, the last time I was on your show, it was responding to yet another Russian threat of nuclear escalation that didn't happen. They do this every time we do something to get inside our heads to force us to back down. And for 3 years, that worked with the Biden administration. Now that they know they're not going to be around anymore, they're actually letting some of these things go. But the bottom line for Russia is the same as it was yesterday and the day before. No strategic use of nuclear weapons makes any sense. Russia will be leveled. And tactical nuclear weapons only make sense if you're defending against an adversary coming into your country, which is their doctrine. Trying to use them for offensive purposes to gain territory in Ukraine makes no sense.
So, Ambassador, the president-elect says he's going to look for some type of a peace ambassador or a treaty ambassador to Ukraine. Would you be willing to do that? Would that be something you're interested in?
President Trump, I think, should have someone like that. I think you need someone who with focus and strength and resolve. And it's entirely President Trump's call who he wants to do that. If called, I'm happy to try to help. But there are plenty of good people out there.
Would you recommend somebody?
Oh, yeah. No, I would. And in fact, if offered, you know, I can talk to the transition, Brian Hooker, others. I have a few people in mind who would be excellent for this.
So I want you to hear. So there's another push, especially with the Republican Party, just to end this. We should just end this. We don't want war. Zelensky's just as bad as Putin. And I've heard that sentiment and it sickens me. But Elbridge Colby, a very confident guy, former deputy assistant defense secretary. Mm-hmm. He's on the team that says, let's just end this. Cut 20.
The American people have delivered a resounding mandate for President Trump to go in a very different direction and try to end the war in Ukraine. And Biden seems to be undermining him here. And even more, Laura, the step doesn't even seem to make sense. The Biden administration basically admitting in The New York Times that the step is unlikely to materially change the military situation. Neither the Ukrainians nor we have sufficient weapons of this type, the ATACMS.
He went on. Cut 21.
The Russians are continuing to move forward. The deputy national security advisor admitted down in Brazil yesterday, I believe, that the situation is extremely difficult and the Russians will always up the ante. So it's this perfect example of the Biden symbolism over effectiveness, which is something that's still very dangerous because, as Lavrov pointed out, Putin himself has made significant threats. And the nuclear thing is very serious. But I would just stress that it's a lot more on the table, horizontal escalation with the Houthis, with Iran, with North Korea, with China, et cetera. So this is, I mean, just digging us deeper into the hole without any sort of progress.
No.
And he doesn't want to give any more weapons over. Your thoughts about his analysis?
Well, yeah. So look, Bridges is a bright guy, but I completely disagree with him on this. And from Bridges' point of view, he worries most about problems we're going to have in the future with China, and we need to prepare for that. I accept that. But if we let Ukraine fail, if we let Putin defeat Trump, if we are seen to be weak in the world, what kind of message is China going to take from that? They're going to think that we don't have the resolve to stand up to China either. So if we actually want to deter China and make them think twice before they would take more serious action in East Asia, it's very important that we get Europe squared away first.
I hear you. How about the fact that Russian weapons newly delivered were found in Hezbollah's cache of weapons recoveries by the IDF?
Yeah, they have no, the Russians have no shame. They are doing this stuff just because they can and because they can get away with it. And with the Houthis and Hezbollah, this is another one where we needed to have stood up to Iran a very long time ago. Rather than giving them billions of dollars and then promising that we don't want to escalate, we don't want a wider war, we should have been threatening them that if they allow their proxies to attack Israel or U.S. or Western interests, they will pay a direct price. And that would have prevented the situation we now have in the Middle East. Now it's harder to put back in the box. But again, we have to put that kind of threat on the table and completely flip our policy on Iran.
Ambassador, I think it's going to go a long way if we could supply our allies with natural gas, if we could find to flood the market with more oil and gas and bring the price of oil down and start pushing China to stop taking Iranian oil or secondary sanction China for doing that. There are things that we could do that would all link together to bring some of these burgeoning fires under control. Do you see it the same
way?
That
is exactly right. Exactly right. We have, again, unnecessarily self-restricted our own natural gas exports, our own oil and gas development and production. And then we worry about the effect on global energy prices if there's not enough supply. So we actually buy from Venezuela and we exempt Russia from sanctions if they're getting money for their energy transactions. Completely backwards. We should be ramping up U.S. oil and gas exports and production. We should be sanctioning Russia and Venezuela, starving the Iranian budget and the Russian budget of the funds that they need to keep funding these wars.
A lot going on, but it seems fixable. I know it's intense, but it is fixable. Ambassador Kurt Volker, thanks so much.
Brian, thank you. Take care.
1-866-408-7669. A lot more to discuss. Including Dr. Oz got named to the Trump administration. I think he's going to be fantastic, just a great intellect. I think Duffy's going to be great at transportation. Anyone's going to be better than Mayor Pete. I think Linda McMahon is just like she oozes confidence and competence. Remember how great she was at small business and see what she's done as real brains behind WWE. There was no show there. There was all business with her. And I think she thoroughly understands Trump. He's putting together a really good team. I know some people are going to be harder than others to get through, but it's a fascinating time. And one thing, these are all good, and they understand Trump. That doesn't mean they're sycophants. That doesn't mean they're yes men and women, but they understand the president-elect, and that's why I think he's going to be so effective. What do you think? 1-866-408-7669. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, if they want to help us get the hell out of the way, we're going to do it. If I got to send twice the amount of resources to that city, that's what we're going to do. If they would give us access to the jail, that would mean less agents in the community. For them pushing back and not letting us in the jail, it just means more agents are going to be in the community, so they're hurting themselves. Finally, I'll say this. They need to educate themselves. They need to review this. Title 8, United States Code, 1324, triple I. Read about that and don't cross that line, because it is a felony to harbor and conceal an illegal alien from ICE. Read the statute. Don't cross that line.
I tell you, I am really shocked that the mayor of Massachusetts, mayor of Boston, the governor of Massachusetts, the governor of Colorado, the governor of California, all digging in. Yesterday, the L.A. City Council passed an ordinance that would keep sanctuary city status in place. That means illegal aliens can't be arrested and they don't have to answer and can't inform ICE of their whereabouts, locations, and their histories. So that means these mayors are so dug in on the open border system and letting citizens and non-citizens be treated equally that they're looking to harbor criminals. Harbor criminals, leave them in prison where we pay for them instead of exporting them to the foreign country that they came from. This is so tone deaf to where the country is right now. I am blown away because also we found a DHS letter that shows the rising tide of located now 16 states that killer gang from Venezuela. The DHS admitted the migrant crime and violence are exploding. This, according to Mayorkas' Department of Homeland Security, he who says crime is among the illegal immigrant community is lower. He who says the border is sealed. Quote, as the population of Venezuela nationally continues to increase, the potential for violent TDA migrants is highly probable. You think? Now we got them in Washington, D.C. We got them in Denver, Colorado, New York, New York City. They are everywhere. We have over in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, we're finding remnants of them. And of course, they consolidate and they metastasize. And then we find that one of their priorities is going to be for Tom Homan and company finding 300,000 plus kids, unaccompanied minors, who they just have lost track of. They refused to DNA test. So if you came across holding a little kid's hand and you were a guy, they said, if you're the father, that's fine. You know what Trump said? Here are the DNA kits. And as soon as those DNA kits came out, these guys would admit, not my kid. I'm a trafficker. They go under arrest. And they have to explain themselves. But they got rid of all that. So now it's going to be a bigger mess than you can imagine. But for those of you who think that some people in your neighborhood who you didn't know didn't have correct documentation, the Canadian down the block, the Mexican who's on your soccer team, whatever it is, they're not going to be subjected for a couple of years, I think. They're going for criminals first. The 100 plus from the FBI watch list that came over the last, terror watch list who came over the last 3.5-4 years. Then they're going to get to these other ones. And there's going to be work visa situations and things amended. But for these mayors to stand up for criminal legal aliens is so tone deaf and doesn't understand what this election actually said. The big weakness for Democrats was the border. They pretended as if that the border plan by Senator Lankford that was just put together at the last minute to stem the tidal wave of people was the answer, and Trump was guilty of not implementing it, and therefore he's guilty of making it a political issue. No, it's a real issue. It became a political issue because of what Joe Biden did. All problems is go on his shoulders, and his borders are, who he named borders are, who just simply refused the crown, and that was Kamala Harris. But quick note on the Trump transition team. According to Axios, it looks like Senator Hagerty is now moved into the top spot to be likely Treasury Secretary. He traveled with the president to SpaceX for the launch yesterday. We know he was ambassador to Japan. He owes the president his political career, would be loyal, and he's smart. He's got a Wall Street background, so he'd have respect for Wall Street. I still think Scott Bessent is the better choice. He has worked with Soros, left Soros, saw what he was up to, self-made multi-billionaire, also has respect to Wall Street.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We've seen the explosion of some trends that have existed before, but not to this extent. Disinformation. You know, Elon Musk is, I don't know how many hundreds of billions he has. He has been the director of misinformation. 2 billion views of his spreading of disinformation. Not just about the economy, but about immigrants, about minorities. We've never seen disinformation at this scale. Next, we have never seen to this scale the agitation of three trends that have been very deeply embedded in American history: misogyny, racism, and xenophobia. You know, the first anti-immigrant law was 1798, and Donald Trump wants to revive it.
This guy's a loser. Alan Lichtman is somebody who prides himself on predicting every victory and had Trump losing. So he's wrong again. He had Trump losing the first time, too. Teresa Payton served as the first female chief information officer for the White House during President Bush's administration, CEO and founder of Fortalice
Solutions.
That's right.
Yeah.
I always say that wrong. Fortalice Solutions, and author of Manipulated, Inside the Cyber War to Hijack Elections and Distort the Truth. So Alan Lichtman talks about misinformation, or is it information that they just don't like? That's one of the keys. Elon Musk deserves a lot of credit for exposing a lot of the misinformation in the Twitter files, which people found abhorrent. Did that whole thing and the exposure surprise you, that the length and breadth in which it was taking place?
It was good to see it validated. My gut told me there must have been, a lot of conversations, because we don't have transparency on who is the arbiter of truth when it comes to misinformation, disinformation. You hit the nail on the head, Brian. A lot of times when somebody labels something misinformation or disinformation, it's because they don't like it, not necessarily that it's not the truth. And so it was stunning to see how prevalent it was. And I think, you know, Mark Zuckerberg kind of raised the white flag and said, well, looking back, maybe we shouldn't have done what we did.
Yeah, that social media is a huge issue. I think we're getting to the point where we have an FCC director, if he gets confirmed, that's really going to go to town on that. We'll see where Google stands, and other countries have done the same thing. The amount of hacking going on, led by China, but not solely China, with North Korea, of course, and Iran, too, is noteworthy. China-linked hackers stole wiretap data for telcos, FBI, and CISA. That's last week. A week ago, too, we learned about the Library of Congress gets hacked. Tell me about the significance, and do you know roughly how the Chinese are doing it?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. So we've got China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, but they're not the only ones playing in this game. And for the record, they all deny they do it. But I always say, if you don't condone it, then condemn it and show us you're putting people in jail for hacking into our systems, which they don't do. But then you also have cyber criminal syndicates doing this as well. But it's very prevalent, and it goes back to, we really need to have the mindset of just assume technology will fail us. Just assume the wrong people will get access to information. So why are we collecting it to begin with? And why aren't we storing things? The technology exists today to make things anonymized, to make things access to it tokenized.
Can you tell me what that means? So,
yeah.
So in other words, only I would know where my secret items are. They're not going to be labeled secret items.
Exactly. Or let's say, so for example, the investigation's still ongoing. We don't know exactly what, at least it hasn't been revealed to us, the hackers, who they were, what they accessed, what they listened to. Did they listen to everyday conversations, political campaign conversations? They did mention in the news reports that they could have potentially accessed the law enforcement surveillance database, the wiretapping. So if you're going to assume that bad guys are going to come after that data, that they're going to be successful in getting that data, then it shouldn't have, you know, Brian and Teresa's conversation labeled as who we are as private citizens, right? And so that's where, first of all, should we be collecting it in the first place? And then secondly, if we are, in the name of, you know, kind of law enforcement or national security or homeland security, then the second thing is assume it will be stolen. So how are we making the data, if it is stolen, useless and anonymized, so that it's not something that could be used against people?
Right. Where would you grade our cyber defense?
Where would I grade us today based on what's coming at us? A C minus.
Scary. Is that because we don't have the best people there? Is that because technically we're not keeping up?
We have great people. We spend a lot of money and a lot of time and attention on this. We're at a point in sort of the maturation of technology innovation that we need to do a zero-based budget on this, and we need to completely reimagine how we think about cybersecurity. Right now, we're just taking kind of last year's threats, looking at what we did and saying we need to do more of these good things. But it's time to take a step back and say, let's reimagine. If we were to build how we think about cybersecurity and building that into the very fabric of how we conduct business as a nation, as our citizens who pay taxes, how would we do it from scratch? And we really do need to reimagine that.
That would certainly help, because I think people have to be open to it. It just can't be any zero ramp up time. It's got to be one to zero to 1,000 when Trump takes over in a few weeks. When you go to the government, though, you're making a major pay cut. If you're like an elite cyber tech, you know, you're cyberly competent and you excel in that area, people want to pay a lot for your skills. For you to go to government, you're never going to be rich. It's got to be like service. And is it possible to get the best in that sense of service?
I'd like to think it is, because I took a pay cut to do my time at the White House under President George W. Bush. And it was an incredible honor, and my whole family.
And it's helped your whole career, right?
It absolutely. And so what I think people need to look at is there's different ways you can serve. Many people in my family serve in the U.S. military and law enforcement. I got my opportunity to serve the country and to give back to the country. And I still do in a variety of different ways behind the scenes. And so what I would tell anybody sitting on the sidelines thinking, gosh, this is going to be a pay cut, doing your patriotic duty for your country by serving in any administration, mm-hmm. And giving your skills back to the country, it's your patriotic duty, and it will pay off for you in the long run.
So China's certainly a threat. We also, with the Library of Congress, why would someone want to hack the Library of Congress?
I don't think people realize the amount of research that goes on between Congress and the Library of Congress. Over 76,000 requests were handled for the Hill last year. And so the back and forth communications from January through September were accessed. Again, we've not been told by who. We have been told that the issue that allowed that access to happen unmitigated for several months has been mitigated. The question still remains, what types of research requests did they see, mm-hmm. and what kind of data points did they see sent back to the Hill?
Do you find it insane that we still are allowing TikTok in this country?
You know what's interesting about TikTok is, so I'm not a huge user of TikTok, but since it was banned, I decided to at least get an account and take a look. And they spent billions of dollars responding to CFIUS, so the Foreign Control Act, and working with Oracle, which has an American origin story, to separate Americans' data and information onto mm-hmm. the Oracle infrastructure. I would like to see, did we do an on-site inspection of TikTok, and what were the findings for that on-site inspection to say, did they actually satisfy CFIUS, you know, to the spirit of the law?
Yeah, if you talk to Mike Gallagher, who put up that special task force on China, said they absolutely have already hacked into some journalists, be able to take their material, and they apologize. And one person that sits on the board is a member of the Communist Party at their government, sits right by President Xi. The back door is wide open. It just so happens our algorithm is extremely attractive to Americans right now. And it, a lot of it, the stuff they learn, you have a lot of anti-Israeli stuff on there, almost no pro-Israeli things, pro-Iran. I mean, you can't say they even don't have their hands on the news feed.
Yeah, you have to wonder from a engineering conscious and unconscious bias, you know, who's tweaking the algorithms there and how are the algorithms working? And, you know, so the question remains, will there be an American investor who steps up and says, well, if it doesn't pass the kind of the CFIUS sniff test, I'll buy it. And so the question remains, will somebody be able to get the funds together, and would the parent company actually sell it?
Yeah, it seems like the president's moving off that now because TikTok's so popular and he's so down on Silicon Valley because they totally turned on him in 2020. They banned him. And he's saying, well, at least I can get on and I can get my followers, but I hope cooler heads prevail. And he starts understanding that China gets acceptance, will get access to a lot of American, be able to manipulate Americans. Can we talk about AI?
Sure.
Where do you think that is heading? I mean, when it has the smartest people in the world like Altman and Musk intimidated about its potential, what should we know?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. You know, one is we really have to understand what are the ethical guardrails around generative AI, predictive analytics using AI and AI algorithms. Who, for example, is looking at the curation of the actual data that's in these large language models? Who's protecting it? And just because we can do something with AI, does it mean that we ethically should? You know, should we be making decisions in a black box on certain things, for example? And again, who's going to be the arbiter of truth and governance of the ethics of AI? We really don't have the right standards in place. And I'm very concerned because we got it so absolutely wrong on social media. You know, the impact on our children, for example, the impact on, we were just talking about algorithms suppressing some things and promoting other things. And we got it so wrong on social media. We have the chance to get it right right now, but I'm seeing the technology far outpacing our lawmakers' ability to create those governance standards.
Right. I mean, we see a whole generation have no communication skills. They've been stuck on their phones, cyberbullied. We're seeing the effects now. Countries around the world, I think the UK, the latest, says no social media until you're 16. We see Australia doing the same thing. And we see, because a lot of these companies have more control maybe than even the parents. On AI, I thought it was interesting. We had Joe Lonsdale on from Palantir. And he said he worries about the guardrails being too tight from government, that we need to be creative and we need to be able to keep up with China. And right now that they think the guardrails are so tight in Congress that it might hinder growth. Your thoughts?
I think that's interesting. I'd love to sit down and have coffee with him and unpack that a little bit to see where he feels like the guardrails are in place and hindering innovation, but
or on their way to being
or on their way. And he could be right about that based on things that might be in committee, legislation that might be in committee. There might be an overreaction because it's hard to explain how the black box works and how you're encountering sort of engineering confirmation bias and sort of the unconscious bias. And so he could be seeing things about pieces of legislation that are still in committee and being concerned about those.
Right. Well, it's certainly a changing landscape. Teresa Payton's going to stick around for a little while longer. She's the author of Manipulated: Inside the Cyber War to Hijack Elections and Distort the Truth. What is Teresa's take on this last election as we know it, although we're still waiting on one Senate race and maybe a couple of House races? You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Teresa Payton is back with us, cyber expert, served with as the first female chief information officer for the White House during the Bush days. I'm also still focusing on that. Does it for a living. When you talk about cybersecurity, there's very few things more valuable for this incoming administration than guarding our secrets. And of course, we know China, North Korea, and Iran and Russia are just four of the main actors going against us. Teresa, something else happened, and that is Russia upset with NATO, I guess, not giving up, have cut the undersea wires, the internet, to Sweden and Finland. They claim they have nothing to do with it, but we saw the ships in that area. How susceptible and how vulnerable are these undersea wires, cables?
They're very vulnerable. So we've seen the past, and it's always been deemed usually accidental, I'll say. So usually deemed accidental of, you know, if a fishing vessel drags an anchor or a cargo vessel drags an anchor, that they've cut those undersea cables. And so we see this week two cables have been damaged. The words used by some of the country's leaders in the European area are sabotage. And so an investigation is ongoing. They're looking at the shipping channels and who's been going through those shipping channels. And Russia's been through there. China's been through there. Mm-hmm. So they're really trying to piece that together. But it could take as long as 15 days to repair some of the damages, to assuming the weather holds, to these undersea cables.
But I thought we were in a wireless world. So I did not know that undersea cables play such a valuable role with sophisticated countries like Sweden and Finland.
Yeah, they do. It's basically part of an overall resiliency. So you typically have a satellite. You've got the low Earth orbit satellites. You've got the ones kind of further out in orbit. Then you have kind of your broadband, your cable that you're running underground or above ground. But then connectivity, a lot of connectivity still happens via these undersea cables.
So I guess that's an issue. Also, we're looking at, obviously, people are looking for advances, consolidation of power, the shrinking of the workforce because of AI. When you go on your privately contract, you mentioned you just came from Europe. How much is it on cybersecurity and how much is your focus on AI and the next step in the art advancement?
Yeah, so there's a huge focus right now in businesses around how can we best leverage AI, and a lot of conversations around how do we govern around sort of ethical use of AI. So if we're going to use it to enable humans, in our operations? How do we do that in a way that's trustworthy, that protects privacy, confidentiality? We don't accidentally put corporate secrets out into the public domain, which is what actually happened to Samsung. They were letting their engineers do coding and using a code assist using AI, and the engineers accidentally flipped a switch, and instead of it staying internal to Samsung, it actually went external. So there's a lot of conversations there. And what I will tell you, Brian, is what's interesting in sort of my conversations behind closed doors is they're not sure they fully see the financial impact to the bottom line in a positive way yet with AI. There's still a lot of sort of pilot and running old processes in parallel with AI. And there's a lot of conversations right now around sort of not replacing humans, but enhancing what humans can get done. So maybe sort of almost giving the lower level tasks. But always right now, what I'm finding is the smartest companies are focused on always keeping the human in the loop. It's when you let the loop run without the human that some of the things get off the guardrails pretty quickly.
Do you feel as though we're still leading the AI race?
We are leading the AI race, but it is, I mean, it's a neck and neck. So, and it's same thing with quantum computing, because quantum computing is going to be sort of the next generation of true compute power. And really, the country that wins the quantum computing race is going to be the country that wins sort of the next decades of innovation.
How would you define quantum computing?
So quantum computing, how it's different from today's computing. Today's computing, no matter how elegant, seamless, and sexy it looks, you know, it might have this really cool interface, it's still ones and zeros. So it's still, you know, a state of on or off. Quantum computing is stateless, so it's neither a one nor a zero. So we're going to be able to see mathematical computations done at a speed and scale we've never seen before.
Wow. We always hear about that. Are you convinced that Trump's got the team, a cyber team? Have you seen anyone on it? I've never heard anything announced about it. Have you?
I haven't seen as much discussed yet on that. I've seen more around sort of the Department of Government Efficiency. I've heard a little bit around technology and innovation. I'm sure there's a lot of discussions already happening on cybersecurity.
Would you be willing to help?
Absolutely be willing to serve my country and help.
Absolutely, as you've already done. Teresa Payton, thanks so much. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th, just blocks where a maniac with 8 prior arrests randomly stabbed and killed 3 people just 2 days ago. Meanwhile, Danny Penny downtown is actually fighting to stay out of prison for being a good Samaritan and saving a subway full of passengers. Just a weird dichotomy of things that are going on in New York that's emblematic of what's happening around the company with crime and lack of punishment. We have a big hour coming your way. Josh Crash Hour is standing by. So let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And there's real concern today that following that approval from the Americans allowing the Ukrainians to launch long-range missiles into Russian territory, that there will be further Russian retaliation. We heard air raid sirens earlier today in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. And the U.S. Embassy here in this population center of about 4 million people issued a rare alert this morning.
Escalation. The Biden administration releases restrictions on mines and missiles. Russia threatens nuclear war, cuts underwater cables to NATO nations, or at least two of them, arms the Houthis and Hezbollah, allies with Iran. The world is on fire. Trump is in the wings. What can he do while he waits?
Number two.
Elections have consequences, but what we can do is make sure that we are doing our part to protect our residents in every possible way, that we are not cooperating with those efforts that actually threaten the safety of everyone.
You are nuts. That is the mayor of Boston. Illegal immigration removal plans begin to take shape. An insane Democratic opposition, like the woman you just heard, digs in. They don't seem to care that criminal aliens are putting their legal citizens in danger.
Number one.
President-elect has made more selections. He's chosen Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick as his commerce secretary, Dr. Mehmet Oz, to run Medicare and Medicaid, and wrestling executive and former administrator of the Small Business Administration in the first term, Linda McMahon. She's Trump's education secretary nominee.
Team taking shape. Trump team adds 2 more major newsers. Dr. Oz and Sean Duffy and others are lining up. will get a Treasury Secretary, I imagine, soon. He's got 1,000 jobs to fill. 4,000 will be filled by other people all in all. And those people will focus on Gates or Tulsi Gabbard. You know, they might not seem to like that nomination, but we'll see what else comes down the pike. So far, there's a lot of people that are loyal to Trump, but they're not sycophants. I think that's a huge difference. Joining us now is Josh Krashauer. Josh, this team is taking shape, but all the focus is really on Gates and a little bit to Tulsi, don't you think?
Yeah, I think RFK, I would put in that same mix at HHS. But I think the most concerted opposition right now is really focused on Trump's attorney general nominee, Matt Gaetz. And, you know, in conversations I've had on Capitol Hill, it does seem like there are a pretty healthy number of Republicans that at the very least are pretty skeptical about whether he has the votes to get confirmed.
So he says, I talked to somebody over the weekend who's been talking with him. He says he's going to be ready. All right. Does he know how to run the Department of Justice? What would he exactly approach? You know, there's scenarios that are going to come up. They're going to ask him about. His intellect can do it, but his background and his history and accomplishments don't seem to add up to it. I mean, I'll let his words speak for themselves, but I know he doesn't have McConnell. I can't picture him having Murkowski. And then there's Collins and Cassidy. I don't know. I mean, he can lose four, right? That's it.
Right. I mean, if you're a Republican senator, you'd prefer not to have the vote in the first place. You don't want to be on record opposing one of Trump's picks for the cabinet. You'd rather just have this. I mean, there's just so many damaging leaks, whether it's the Ethics Committee investigation we're already hearing about some of the most bothersome and salacious details from that. You know, there's going to be a lot more to come, and I don't think you even want to get to the point where you have a vote. You mentioned the names. I mean, I think McConnell's the most interesting one to watch, Brian, because he's not running the caucus anymore. He's not majority leader, he's not minority leader, and he's retiring after 2026. So he really is going to be something of a free agent, and I think his lead is going to actually set the tone for some of these nominees, not just Gates, but other ones going forward.
Have you noticed about President Trump? I've never seen him more deliberative, calm. I mean, he's been called out. You have these mayors, these liberal mayors looking to push back against and keep their sanctuary city status, locking arms in order to fight back and be Trump proof. And he has not taken the bait. Are you surprised?
He's been in a very good mood, and who wouldn't be after the victory that he achieved on election night? He has a lot of political capital. He has a pretty healthy Senate majority. Narrow. One of the undercovered stories, I think, is that the House majority is pretty narrow with some of these races going down to the wire in California. But you know, look, he thinks he has a mandate, and he's definitely pushing forward in a much more deliberative and also more efficient manner than he did back in 2016. So the big test is going to be he really is sort of pressing the system, picking some folks who are very much close to him, loyal to him, but a lot of skepticism on Capitol Hill and in the Senate. So that'll be a big test early on of how much exactly political capital he has and who's going to end up getting through.
So I want you to hear Chris Landau last night with Laura, Cut 7.
They're going to try to throw everything at the wall to see what sticks. We saw that already in the first Trump administration. Basically, every policy initiative the administration rolled out was challenged in court. And I think the good thing is Trump 2.0 knows how to deal with that and knows how to get things up through the legal process a lot more quickly to get resolution. But it's not just the ACLU. It's also Democratic governors and mayors have basically announced a campaign of massive resistance to federal attempts to enforce immigration law.
So Chris Landau is the ambassador to Mexico. The Remain in Mexico has got to be put back in place. He's going to finish that wall and he's going to deport criminals before they even get to people who overstayed their visa or missed their court date. So Chris Landau is someone who says this is what they're up against. Josh, are you surprised in this atmosphere, knowing how fed up people are with people like Rachel Morin who lose their lives and what we're seeing every day on trial with Lake and Riley? And we see the growing of now in presence of 16 cents of the Venezuelan gang. None of these mayors have taken a step back and saying maybe we should rethink our anti-Trump, pro-sanctuary city beliefs?
Well, look, Donald Trump certainly has a mandate to act aggressively on immigration, on some of the deportations of the criminals in the country. That was an issue that he ran on. That was an issue that he had a huge advantage on. It was an issue that was one of the most important to voters across the country. So that is one. And Tom Homan, being the border, essentially the new border czar, is someone who gets things done and he has a good relationship with. So if there's any front where I expect to be a lot of movement and to be a real priority in the first 100 days, it's going to be immigration and border security. And he's already, he's obviously already gotten moving on that front. But that is an area where I've even noted there are some of the usual suspects like Gavin Newsom, J.B. Pritzker, the governor of California and Illinois, that have tried to be part of the resistance. But I've actually heard from other Democratic leaders, mayors and governors that are not that are changing their tune a little bit and understand that illegal immigration has really put a strain in their cities or in their states. And they're actually much more pragmatic this time around. I think you're not hearing the same kind of resistance rhetoric from a wide range of Democrats like you did in 2016.
I want you to hear Tom Homan. He's ready for the resistance. Cut 9.
Well, if they want to help us get the hell out of the way, we're going to do it. If I got to send twice the amount of resources to that city, that's what we're going to do. If they would give us access to the jail, that would mean less agents in the community. For them pushing back and not letting us in the jail, it just means more agents are going to be in the community, so they're hurting themselves. Finally, I'll say this. They need to educate themselves. They need to review this. Title 8, United States Code, 1324, triple I. Read about that and don't cross that line because it is a felony to harbor and conceal an illegal alien from ICE. Read the statute. Don't cross that line.
He's got a legal maneuver. It's not just acting tough. And the other thing is, you have 300,000 unaccompanied minors. We don't know where they are. And you could say Tom Homan wants to crack down and build a wall and crack down on criminals. Sure. But he also wants to find children in our country and reform a system that's not tracking them and get DNA back to the border where if you're coming with a kid, we want to know that's your kid. For some reason, they stopped that. And Mayorkas admitted the growing threat of Venezuelan criminal gangs in our country, that this is an internal memo that emerged. This is actually worse, I think, Josh, than I thought.
Yeah, I mean, look, Tom Homan is the guy who I think he, if there's anyone who can really bang some heads together and really get things done, Tom Homan has a record of that kind of accomplishment. I also think the politics play a pretty big role where, if you do have someone like a Newsom or a Pritzker trying to, not let, ICE or have access to the jails or any of the criminals that are potentially in the country, that's a 90-10 issue. that you start with the low-hanging fruit politically, and if Democrats want to prevent enforcement of immigration law against criminals and people who have committed crimes in this country, mm-hmm. They're going to continue to really pay a political price, I would think, for that, for the Democratic Party.
Josh, what's going on in Treasury?
Well, I think Donald Trump is back, is really at door number three. Lutnick got Commerce yesterday. He was as head of the co-head of the transition, he was mentioned as a possible Treasury Secretary, doing a little bit of maybe some bureaucratic wrangling behind the scenes, but he's not going to be Treasury Secretary. I've heard that Scott Bessent is less likely to end up at Treasury. He may have another high level economic position in the administration. But two names I would look at Treasury that have emerged in the last 24 hours. Senator Hagerty of Tennessee has really jumped up on the list, from what I've understood, that he's in serious consideration for the Treasury post. And Mark Rowan, who is the CEO of Apollo, that's another name who very well respected on Wall Street and is someone who has met with Trump or is meeting with Trump and is being considered for that position.
I think Scott Bessent is still in the mix. I'm not really sure. What is the hesitancy there? Because he's been constantly with the president, for the president-elect, for a while. So we'll see. If I can, before I let you go, can we talk about what's happening in Ukraine? I mean, this thing is a live hand grenade by the time Trump gets it, whether he likes it or not. We have Biden doing something, in my view, he should have done 3 years ago, and that is allow ATACMS to be used wherever they need to be used. He's now letting them use landmines to stop the forward progress of the from the Russians. The Russians threatening nuclear war. Your thoughts about where this is right now?
Well, it looks like we're in a position where the U.S. is escalating, perhaps to de-escalate when Trump takes office. I mean, in a weird way, the ratcheting up of tensions may play a role in being the first move in terms of some kind of negotiation and trying to make the negotiations more favorable to Western terms. I think this, you're right, Brian, I think it's very volatile. It could get very ugly. Russia lowered the threshold yesterday on, you know, when they say they can use nuclear weapons. It's really raising anxieties throughout the West. And I think it's going to be a pretty bumpy road for the next month or so. And they're also going to be trying to test the new president. You know, President Trump is going to be tested in his opening months. And I think it's very concerning what Russia may try to do with President Trump in office. And I think the national security team has to be up to task in realizing that Putin is going to be continuing to create mischief and creating problems in Ukraine and beyond.
And we know the Republican caucus is divided. Some just say, just don't worry about it. We don't have we don't want to pick winners there, when it's so clear to me Russians are the bad guys. They're the problem in the area. They're the ones who did the invading. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, cut 19.
Well, number one, if you had given them the ability to fight early on, we'd be better off than we are today. But we're 1,000 days into this war. Ukraine is still standing. This war is about money. People don't talk much about it. But you know the richest country in all of Europe for rare earth minerals is Ukraine? $2 to $7 trillion worth of minerals that are rare earth minerals, very relevant to the 21st century. Ukraine's ready to do a deal with us, not the Russians. So it's in our interest to make sure that Russia doesn't take over the place. It's the breadbasket of really the developing world. 50% of all the food going to Africa comes out of Ukraine. We can make money and have an economic relationship with Ukraine that'd be very beneficial to us with peace.
He sees all sides. He also knows what gets Trump's attention. Oil, that's why he kept troops in Syria. He didn't want to give that to the Iranians. And also, when it comes to Ukraine, they have a lot of natural resources.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's sort of a mystery on how Trump is going to handle the Russia-Ukraine war and how he's going to handle Putin in his second term. Obviously, Lindsey is one of his close confidants and is making the case, certainly on economic grounds, that And then that's an influential one. But there's going to be a lot of tensions. You said it, Brian. There are a lot of divisions within this cabinet, within this national security team over the issue. I think Rubio and Waltz have generally been pretty solid on pushing back against Russia and supporting Ukraine. But there are other folks that share a different view. So it's going to be a team of rivals, if you will. And it could, there's going to be a lot of volatility on that front going forward.
Hey, Josh, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, political analyst Josh Krasher. When we come back, we'll take your calls. To see you out there in Jacksonville and Illinois, 1-866-408-7669. And then we'll continue to keep you up to date on the expanding cabinet situation. Also, Trey Yink sat down with Zelensky yesterday. He gave us some new cuts from that interview. I'll share them with you on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Now, this period, this moment depends, I think, on our unity in Ukraine. And I think that what is very dangerous, if we will lose unity in Europe, and what is most important, unity between Ukraine and the United States.
Think about this guy. He's an actor a short time ago. He takes over a country, thought he could make peace with Russia. He used to live there. And it ended up being just the opposite. And they were not prepared because Biden stopped the last weapon shipment there. The only reason they had javelins was because of Trump. Now, I know he didn't love Ukraine. And that's what the senator, Rudy Giuliani, walking through, trying to find out about the Biden corruption. And there was plenty of it. But it resulted in an impeachment. So Trump was put off by it. So now you got a raging war there once he leaves. And Zelensky's got to rally his country, very divided, got to rid the place of corruption on the fly, extremely tough, rally NATO, and he's not a member, and make sure the U.S. leads the way. Who he's a little ticked off at, but he can't voice it because the weapon shipments are getting slow and the restrictions were too great. And all of them get released from the HIMARS now to the ATACMS. No F-16s, got F-16s. And now he's got to keep everything together through a transition with the world superpower. And he's got to do it by letting them know this is in your interest. It's not a favor. And he's right. Ron in Jacksonville. Hey, Ron.
How are you? Well, I would tell Zelensky that the next money he's getting is for infrastructure, not for weapons, and that he has to agree to end the war in 30 days. And let's see how he acts.
Who, Putin?
No.
Well, how does he end a war in 30 days when the other guy keeps attacking him?
Because Trump is going to also impose sanctions against Russia until he gets...
He's got to do something, but the problem is he was attacked. So you can't stop a guy from punching you in the face by saying, I want to declare peace. You got to put your hands up, and then you got to hit back. So everyone should know who the bad guy, Ron. You know what? Stay on. I'll talk to you on the break. It's not fair because you called up to talk about Gates, and I brought you into that. So we'll get you in just a moment. So don't move if you can do it. If not, we'll get you next time. But stick around. Brian Kilmeade Show. More calls next. And we also have this developing story on FEMA. They will not help if you have a Trump sign in your yard.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's very clear that the DOJ has been enemy number one for Trump and those around him. And this pick seems to indicate that he plans to kind of follow through on retribution towards that agency. And, you know, it was pretty remarkable to hear and see the reaction to the announcement from the Hill. So many people were, you know, texting me, talking to me in the hallways, just shocked at the decision, shocked at the nomination, and casting a lot of doubt on whether he could actually get through the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Every single president has somebody that doesn't get through, that's unorthodox. This president lives on being unorthodox, and people are beginning to get used to it. I noticed Thomas Friedman wrote today in the editorial, and I'm thinking, okay, they're going to eviscerate him as usual. And instead, they say the guy who wrote the most detailed plan about a two-state solution in the Middle East is this guy named Donald Trump, led by Jared Kushner. And here's his opportunity for peace. And I thought, let me keep reading. And Donald Trump called him at the end of his first term to say thanks for saying nice things about the Abraham Accords. And Thomas Friedman is someone who leans left, but he really knows the Middle East. To his great credit, very smart guy with great contacts. But, you know, he thought Joe Biden was a great president and Barack Obama walked on water. So, and I thought he was relatively fair to George W. Bush, but he had no patience for an outsider like Donald Trump. And hopefully people are coming around to it. And I'll get to your calls in a second. I'm not forgetting. But another person who maybe we can, Pete, maybe we can catch up to is Peggy Noonan, who has been vehemently anti-Trump. And I thought, well, you know, she's a great thinker, fantastic writer, speechwriter. But, like, do I really need to book somebody else that just doesn't like Trump? And maybe she's coming around a little. She was on with Jesse last night. She's got a book out. Cut two.
One sense is, as you look at the political landscape right now, it's a jumble and it's frothing and it's boiling still. I don't think 2024 quite settled things. One of the things I've been talking to people about who say this is a great populist moment, this is the rise of populism, it'll never go back, I say, a thoughtful populism will be a very powerful thing in this country. The kind of thoughtful populism that knows so much needs to be shaken up, but many things also need to be kept a little stable. Things are a little bit fragile. I think, you know, I often think there's an old farmer's quote, which is that any donkey can knock down a barn, but it takes a man to build one. So have a sense. I know you're knocking things down, but you know what? We got to build and we have to refortify too.
Yeah. So what she's saying is, look, I'm open to change. Pentagon should be open to change. Elon Musk and Vivek and Joe Lonsdale and others open for reform. But there's also some things that should be stabilized because you don't want to unnerve everybody and unmoor everything without a plan to rebuild. So I think that's a message taken. I think it shows that people are more open to it. And part of it is because of you guys. You guys went ahead. Democrats and Republicans just voted for Trump and gave him a popular vote, which many people thought was impossible in this landscape with big states like California and New York are always going to lean left. But more and more didn't. And now I think critics are recalibrating because they got 4 years to evaluate and they don't want to look in the rearview mirror yet because now they have to look through the windshield because rearview mirror is 2016 to 2020. The windshield is 2020 to 2024. Ron, I want to continue with you. And you wanted to talk about Gates. I apologize.
Yes. You're talking about his experience. Well, Gates has a lot more experience than a former attorney general you may have heard of, Robert F. Kennedy.
RFK Jr. Okay. Yeah. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s dad. Got it. Never tried a case either. Like you said, never tried a case. But right. would you say then, number one, I wasn't there at the time. He was probably 34, I think, when he became attorney general.
Right.
He just didn't have the track record as a agitator that Matt Gaetz had. And he certainly didn't have the ethical background.
But that's what we need. And I wanted to say how Trump is going to get him on board. In 1998, there was the Federal Vacancy Reform Act was passed. And what that does, it gives the president the authority to temporarily fill a vacant position with an acting official subject to time limitations. The time limitations is 210 days, but it's renewable. So if the Senate does not confirm him that time, he can go ahead and request another 210 days.
So doesn't the Democrats have a say in that?
They have a say in it, but they can't overrule it because it's law.
Do you think there's any way for him traditionally to get confirmed? Do you think it's going to be the back door?
Well, the Senate has a choice. They can either go the normal way or they can try to be the opposition and just delay things. But it's not going to stop them from putting them in place. And I would advise people to go on YouTube and see Gates in action, because he is exactly who we need to clean out the DOJ.
Well, he's certainly going to watch the president's back, but I think there's other people with more experience to run a department that hasn't spent most of his time alienating fellow Republicans and ousting a great speaker in Kevin McCarthy. But we'll see. Matt Gaetz is going to have his chance to prepare, and he's going to see if he can get confirmed. We know one thing. He is bright. And I know, number two, he's a great communicator. Fantastic. And most of his antagonists should realize that. Ron, thank you. Thanks for holding on. Just quick thing on Jacksonville. That's where I just called WOKV listeners specifically. On the 15th of January, I cannot wait to go to the Florida Theater. We had a theater which was right off A1A, which was fantastic. But now we're going to look to get double the number of people, from 550 to over 1,000. So we'll hope to fill it up with everybody in the region in northern Florida and Georgia. So go to BrianKilmeade.com, History, Liberty, and Laughs. We bring my books to life in history. And, of course, it's inspirational, motivational, BrianKilmeade.com. Joseph in Illinois. Hey, Joseph.
Hey, yeah, I've been listening to you for many years now.
Thank you.
What got me involved in politics, to be honest with you. You and Jimmy, I listen to you guys every day. But I just want to let you know, with Pritzker and, you know, him saying what he's going to say, he's going to have to go through him. Well, you know, after I travel all throughout the state for work, and I go to all sorts of towns, I see the people out there and see how they're struggling. I'm also a veteran. I go to the VA. I see the homeless veterans just chilling out there every day, because that's the only place they're allowed to go while these migrants are getting these hotels in downtown. And I see it downtown. You know, right now we're having an issue with the tent cities of migrants all over the lakefront, or one of the most beautiful lakefronts in the country. And they're not doing anything about it. They're kicking out the homeless people and letting the migrants stay there.
So, Joseph, just for people listening around the country, so what you're saying is your governor says, I'm going to fight off Trump and Tom Homan and his push to remove illegal immigrants. He's pushing for that tent city. He's pushing out vets. He's making the Illinois citizen, the resident, secondary to illegal immigrants who are providing nothing to the region, many of which are criminals, correct?
Yeah, and when it comes to the VA, I'm getting the bare minimum health care through the VA right now and stuff that I really need. And they're telling me that, you're going to have to go to outpatient to do this because you don't qualify for this. But yeah, all these immigrants are getting money for free from my taxpayer money and everybody else's to go get what they need, while I'm being told by the VA that, sorry, we can't do that for you.
Crazy.
If you want that type of health care, you got to go somewhere else.
And Joseph, the people have to send a message. I saw that city council meeting last Friday. I saw African-Americans standing up screaming at the city council, how dare you prioritize illegal immigrants, how they've taken over their towns, how they're taking their money, how kids can't get into their gyms and the Boys and Girls Clubs because they're now housing illegal immigrants, how airports are an embarrassment to the city, and they will not even entertain or put up to a vote removal of the sanctuary status of that city. And it's just people have to rise up and realize you have an alternative. And you elected it. You maybe didn't vote for it, but you have an alternative. You'll have an ally in the area. You have to get rid of these idiot mayors, like the one you guys have, they have right now. This Mayor Wu in Boston, who thinks she's sticking up for people by pushing back against ICE, who wants to remove criminals from their city. Those days are done. And if you want to know about the other sub-story that's not getting enough attention, it's the 300,000-plus unaccompanied minors that have just disappeared. That is a big story. Alicia Hopper was at Capitol Hill yesterday testifying to what she saw. Cut 10.
Tragically, the horrors don't end at the border. The very system meant to protect vulnerable children has become a trafficking pipeline. An OIG report recently revealed that 324,000 unaccompanied children processed at the border are currently accounted for. Policies from the Biden-Harris administration prioritizing speed over safety have placed children with unvetted sponsors, increasing their risk. Furthermore, this administration's decision to eliminate DNA testing to verify familial relationships has created dangerous loopholes which traffickers are now currently aware of and actively exploiting.
And you know, DNA testing, it's not blood test. What they do is they just have a petri dish and they have a cotton swab. And they swab the inside of your mouth, they compare it to the kid, they tell you to wait, and then they find out if you really are related to that kid. And the minute you're not, you're under arrest. And before that, as soon as they pick out the cotton swab, you see these guys run. And if the word gets out that they're testing at the border, it stops. Do you see how it's all connected? You see why they can't come out and just say, we're going to leave farm workers and landscapers alone? They are. By the time they get to them, hopefully they'll have a work visa situation that makes it more palatable and practical. But if they say, the criminals will pretend to be workers. The landscapers will be kicked out and criminals will be taken over. Gangsters will be hiding in that way because that's the way they'll exploit our vulnerability. That's why it seems like he's kicking out all of them. But as you know, he couldn't possibly kick out 18 million people. But the 1.4 million who have overstayed their visas, 324,000 kids we can't get track of, the gangsters and those on the terror watch list, they're going to be tracked down. And we have the guys and the women to do it. And we got the guy in charge to implement it. George in Missouri. Hey, George.
Hi, Brian. Putin will not use tactical nukes over Ukraine. The nuclear fallout blows east, and it will poison their agricultural market basket. They will be poisoning themselves if they drop those nukes.
Couple of things. I think you're right. And the other thing they have is leverage. China told Putin no nukes. And they said that early. You know, I'll support you. The dual-use weapons, they're ignoring us and they're helping them. But the one thing they want is no nukes because they know it's going to be totally out of control. But you're right.
They literally shoot themselves in the foot.
But it's worked, right? George, it's worked. It's intimidated President Biden to slow down all his decisions. How many people died? How many energy grids were blown up? Because President Biden sat on his hands when they asked for missile defense, he said no. They asked for Patriots, he said no. They asked for HIMARS, he said no. They asked for F-16s, he said no. And he eventually said yes to all of it. It's the worst leadership. If you have a leadership institute, please queue up Joe Biden waffling on everything and say
Brian,
the opposite.
It's not just foreign policy. It's the worst leadership in everything, domestic policy as well.
No argument, George. George, do you have a military background?
No, I don't, but I've studied it.
You sound like you do. Hey, Lewis is in Florida. Hey, Lewis.
Hey, Brian, good morning. Here we go. Ukraine peace, 90 to 120 days. Firstly, temporary ceasefire and a peace summit between Trump and Putin, and then Zelensky comes in once they have a deal. In the deal, a pledge no NATO membership for approximately 10 years. Dropping sanctions per specific metrics of a trade deal. Russia keeps Crimea and Donbass. Ukraine leaves Russian territory. British peacekeepers, and finally, to seal the deal, open one of the two pipelines so Russia can make some money.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, this is the type of talk you have to have, but you are rewarding an invasion of a country and the killing of hundreds of thousands for no reason because you read some history book that told you some czar told you Ukraine belongs to Russia. That's my issue. The other thing is, I don't know if I want to wait 10 years to put Ukraine in NATO. Number two is, but, you know, maybe also I want security guarantees, but not from Russia. They have to be, there's got to be missiles on their border, almost like the Persian 2s that were in the Soviet era that stood in West Germany. They need to know there's a tripwire going forward because we don't trust a word you say. And we got a little bit of a credibility problem, too, because we told them in the 90s, if you give up your nukes, we got your back, and we didn't. And they did.
Brian, real quick, we have to separate them from China. War may be coming with Taiwan. You don't want to fight both of them at the same time. You want to separate Russia from China.
How do you do that, though? How do you do that?
You do that by bringing Russia, which is a Western civilization. They don't like China. They stole Vladivostok from the Chinese after World War II. The Chinese will take it back as soon as they can. You want to separate them by you have to bring in Russia back into a discussion with NATO and the United States. You have to give up some things, some of the things that you're talking about. You have to put British or NATO peacekeepers.
Lewis, the problem is you're dealing with an irrational actor. And the people around him. This guy has gotten crazier by the year. Not saying he's stupid. I'm saying he's crazy, insane, ruthless, bloodthirsty, and he's got nothing to live for except for acquiring more land. He has totally insulated himself. I think Trump's going to find that he's even more maligned than he was when he left. But it is a goal to separate the two, but I just don't think that would have anything to do with it. Tony in Albany. Hey, Tony.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
Great.
Brian, I was going to talk to you about Gates, but this last conversation when you mentioned everything that Biden hasn't done in Ukraine, holding back the planes, et cetera, the MiGs, this guy got $3.5 million to his family from a Russian oligarch. He's been playing ball with Russia.
Who has?
From day one, and that's why he's slow walking. But getting to Gates.
Oh, you're talking about Biden family.
Yeah, the Biden family. But as far as Gates goes, the same situation with Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh. They trump up something that's not even close to factually true. She had two witnesses that said they were never at the party, never, ever saw Kavanaugh. They were her two best friends, supposedly. Her case was nothing but a slander dump, right? What they're doing with Gates is very similar.
But how do you just feel? Let's say there's no ethics problem. How do you think he's acted? How do you think he's performed?
I don't like what he did with McCarthy. I'm with you on that.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure in his mind he thought he was fighting for the right thing. It isn't like he's a bad guy and wants to hurt. He believes in what he was fighting for. Unfortunately, he hurt one of the best guys we ever had there.
Thanks so much, man. I got your point. Unfortunately, I'm against a break, but I did want to squeeze you in. We're going to come back. I have some more thoughts to bring forward. We also have a new person in the Trump cabinet as a nominee. We'll explain who it is in just a moment. Don't move.
Honest commentary, unique opinions, no agenda. It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, we're back. Just finishing up this hour here. I went a little long. I got caught up with the calls, but it's just so great to hear your point of view. Just by the way, your point of view matters. So if you disagree with me, it is totally okay to call and say I'm wrong. I think it makes the show better, actually. Just be ready to back it up. I have nothing against any of the president's nominees. I just know some of them are going to have trouble. And the nomination process, I think it's showtime. You got to show up and you got to be ready. What exactly are you going to do? How are you going to explain your background? Why are you better than the last person? And then what are you going to bring to the table? It's going to have a lot to do with that. BrianKilmeade.com. See you in Jacksonville. History, Liberty, and Laughs. Be there.
From high top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade coming your way. It should be an exciting time. I mean, from the election, historic, shocking, and then you see momentum gathering around President Trump and his picks coming forward. Some people love him. Some people think they're controversy. Some people need to know, want to know what they're about, who they are. And then more conventional. Like, does anyone say anything bad against Marco Rubio? Nobody, as far as I know. I mean, they're pumped up for it. Michael Waltz, not that he has to get confirmed, but people love, really respect him. And who wouldn't on both sides of the aisle? Just a great guy. More controversial ones, Pete Hegseth. If he can get through the confirmation process, I think he'd do a phenomenal job, really gets it. I think recruiting would go up the day he was confirmed. And that is desperate and underreported story, which not be underreported if Trump takes over. And then we got the myriad of challenges around the world that's taking place. We also have this breaking news. A person that you guys are pretty familiar with, Matt Whitlock, has been named ambassador to NATO. That's a pretty good position. That's something Rumsfeld had in the past. Jonathan Turley at the bottom of the hour, talk about the president's charges that stay with him in New York. Never should have been charged to begin with, let alone convicted. It looks like they might want to wait 4 years in order to sentence him. Unbelievable, right? Trey Yinks is standing by. So let's get, before we get to Trey, let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's big three.
Number three.
And there's real concern today that following that approval from the Americans allowing the Ukrainians to launch long-range missiles into Russian territory, that there will be further Russian retaliation. We heard air raid sirens earlier today in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. And the U.S. Embassy here in this population center of about 4 million people issued a rare alert this morning.
Escalation. The Biden administration releases restrictions on mines and missiles. Russia threatens nuclear war. Cut underwater cables to two NATO nations. Arms to Houthis and Hezbollah. The world's on fire. What can Trump do on the sidelines? What should he be ready to handle?
Number two.
Elections have consequences, but what we can do is make sure that we are doing our part to protect our residents in every possible way, that we are not cooperating with those efforts that actually threaten the safety of everyone.
That is Michelle Wu, the mayor of Boston. Illegal immigration removal plans begin to take shape. Insane Democratic opposition as they seem to care more about criminal aliens than their legal citizens.
Number one.
President-elect has made more selections. He's chosen Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick as his commerce secretary, Dr. Mehmet Oz to run Medicare and Medicaid, and wrestling executive and former administrator of the Small Business Administration in the first term, Linda McMahon. She's Trump's education secretary nominee.
Trump team two taking shape. Major names just announced. Dr. Oz, Linda McMahon, Sean Duffy. Other nominees lining up, still looking for a Treasury Secretary. We all hope it's Scott Bessent, good friend of the show. Speaking of good friend of the show, Trey Yinks. He goes from one war zone to another, from Gaza to Lebanon and over to Ukraine. That's where he is now. Fox News' chief foreign correspondent, fresh off an interview with President Zelensky. Trey, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And also pick up his book, Black Saturday, an unfiltered account of the October 7th attack on Israel and the war in Gaza. Trey, first off, and we have a second now, unlike TV, just to breathe a little bit, your impression of Zelensky, who you interviewed during the initial stages of the war. Now we're 1,000 days in.
Yeah, many things are the same and many things are quite different with the situation and with the wartime leader. I saw Zelensky before the Russian invasion of Ukraine began in early February of 2022. We were in the Kherson region near Crimea in southern Ukraine, and he looked a lot younger then. He has gone through a lot as a wartime leader, and he's been trying to keep this country afloat amid daily Russian missile and drone attacks and, of course, the ground invasion that continues in the eastern part of this country. It was a fascinating look into the man who is leading Ukraine right now, and really unprecedented access to spend time with him along the front lines as his soldiers are trying to stop what are rapidly increasing Russian advances.
So where did you go with him?
So I'll give you a little breakdown of this and how it happened. It was a last-minute opportunity that came together after a lot of conversations that took place behind the scenes. But basically, this assignment was so sensitive, Brian, that I didn't know where we were going as we boarded this train to eastern Ukraine. We were told to arrive at a location in the middle of the night. There was a train there with very few lights on, President Zelensky's train. We boarded, and again, we were not told where the train was headed. We just knew we were going east. And on an hours-long train ride, around 9 hours, we made it to eastern Ukraine, got out into vehicles, and then traveled in the close bubble of Zelensky for more than 10 hours along the eastern front lines, going to Pokrovsk, a frontline city that the Russians have been trying to take for the past 8 months. We also went to Kramatorsk, a military hub in the east, and the city of Kupiansk, north of there, closer to the Russian border. And spending time with Zelensky at these locations, you could see that out of almost any world leader I've interacted with, and I've met many, he was, I would say, the most personable. He seems like an average guy who is now the president of a country at war. And we talked extensively about the situation, not just on the ground in the East, but what it's been like as a human amid this war. And it was quite interesting to go to these locations. He gave some soldiers awards for their efforts on the front lines battling the Russians. He also inspected some trenches that were being dug to stop a Russian advance, and then went and met with other commanders in the field. And so, again, it was just an opportunity to talk to him in a very casual setting. And then on that train ride back to the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, we sat down for around an hour, and we talked quite frankly about the war and where things stand today.
And I have the sound bites, but I just your takeaway. You know, you could always tell, Trey, when people are spinning, especially at war, they don't have no choice. But, you know, that pause they take before they answer, the question they don't want, what they want to get out. So where do you think he thinks the war's at?
My sense is that he has accepted the reality on the ground, and that's that Ukraine will continue to fight, but they're not going to be able to claw back the territory in the east that the Russians are currently occupying, let alone Crimea, an area of land that was annexed by Russia in 2014. And so my sense is that he does want a diplomatic solution, but he wants to be negotiating from a position of strength. And I think that that's actually one area where President-elect Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine will see eye to eye on this idea of peace through strength. They both use this line. So do the Israelis, actually, as a matter of fact. But it's something that I think we should look out for. I think he understands that the new administration is going to want some sort of agreement, but he doesn't want to give up territory at a cheap rate, despite the fact that much of it, around 20% of his country, is currently being held by Russia. And so my sense is that in the coming months, we will start to see Ukraine shift closer to the negotiating table. They may not sit down yet, but they're probably pulling out the chair, preparing to.
You know, I think he's dealing with an unhinged opponent. This is not the same guy. And he just doesn't, who has taken, and if the estimates are correct, 700,000 troops have been removed from the battlefield, dead or wounded. I mean, this guy is paying an awful price, isolated in the world, desperate to try to get off the dollar. I mean, it's not, this is not the same world that Putin was in before the pandemic, before the invasion. Who does he think Putin is now? Does he think he's changed?
No, he thinks he is the same person. And I asked him about this, and we actually talked about the possibility of World War III, which was sort of surreal, sitting down with the president of this country and talking about the possibility of a world war that would be sparked by what's happening where we were standing at the time. And some of the Russian lawmakers reacted to the fact that the Ukrainians are now using long-range U.S.-supplied missiles into Russia, saying that this could start World War III. And he said something really interesting. And, you know, Brian, as we're talking now, I should try to get this soundbite on TV, because maybe we'll do it tomorrow, because it's really interesting. He said something to the effect of, there are North Korean troops now fighting in this war. Iranian missiles are soaring through our skies. How do you define a world war? And I'm paraphrasing what he said here, but this was the point he was trying to make, was that the world is already participating in this conflict. There are U.S.-supplied weapons coming into Ukraine, European weapons coming into Ukraine, now North Korean soldiers on the battlefield, the Russians using Iranian missiles and drones. And so the point he was trying to make is basically asking the question of, what does a world war look like in today's age? And this could be partially won.
You know, the thing is, when the North Koreans came in, I thought it was surreal. It's the most underreported big story around. Now people are wising up to it. And then we see that report from South Korea, Bloomberg, that says that they North Koreans are on track to put up maybe 100,000 people into this fight. Can you believe this? North Koreans fighting in Eastern Europe? I mean, this is crazy. Here's a little of Zelensky. He's looking to hope keep his side together in your interview. Cut 18.
Now, this period, this moment depends, I think, on our unity in Ukraine. And I think that what is very dangerous if we will lose unity in Europe, and what is most important, unity between Ukraine and the United States.
So he's trying to keep it together, and that's why I have an infinite amount of respect for him. He's got to deal with all these NATO nations. He's got to keep them supplying it. He's got to make sure they see themselves in this conflict. He's got to keep his hand out in order to fight, not for goods, but for military equipment. And he's got to keep all these plates in the air while keeping his country inspired and in the fighting mode. Right? I mean, this is a colossal task that he's been doing for over 1,000 days.
Yeah, and I think that when Ukraine is discussed in the political echelon of Washington, D.C., and among lawmakers on Capitol Hill, I think they forget the reality on the ground. Look, Ukraine has its faults, right? It's a country filled with corruption, and there's a lot of sketchy deals taking place here even before the war. And people that maybe don't represent what a traditional democracy looks like to the United States, but it's certainly objectively more free than Russia. And its values as a country and a people align more closely with the Americans. These are objective facts. And so when you're looking at who's going to win this war and take over territory in Europe in 2024 into 2025, these are legitimate things to think about. And that's part of what he's asking for, is for the world to keep this in mind. And when you step back and you think about what he is up against, he's up against an army that in some regards is 10 times the size of his own. And he's trying to defend his country and a country that likes the United States, that shares values with the American people. And so it makes sense that he's asking for support, for money, and for weapons to continue the fight. And the one consistent thing that I've heard from Zelensky from when I interviewed him last year in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, and from when I spoke to him even before the war started, was that he is not calling for U.S. boots to be on the ground. He's not asking Ukrainian partners to directly be involved in the fight. He's asking that his soldiers be given the tools to push back the Russians. And as we saw during the Biden administration, there was an objectively difficult situation at hand that the Ukrainians were being placed in. And it was the Americans sort of trickling weapons into Ukraine that they knew ultimately they were going to give Ukraine, but they just weren't delivering them on time. And then they would deliver them, but the Ukrainians had already lost territory. And so we're seeing a little bit of that now, and it's shifting in a different way, but even with these long-range missiles, right? The ATACMS that everyone's talking about this week, they were delivered to Ukraine in April. Ukrainians have had them, and they've been burning a hole in their pockets. They've been waiting to use them as the Russians stage in the Kursk region, preparing to push the Ukrainians out and then ultimately try to go deeper into Ukraine. And they weren't given the ability to do so until now. And even now, according to reports, they're not able to strike anything they want in Russia. There's a very specific target list that they have to adhere to.
Yeah, I guess so. And the Storm Chaser, I think they're called, for the UK, they're told to, the US is telling the UK to hold off. I'm thinking to myself, they're their own country. If they're going to give weapons to Ukraine, they should be able to tell the Ukrainians what they can do and not do with them.
It's just interesting because the billions and billions of taxpayer dollars that are going to Ukraine, Zelensky made an interesting point, actually, and I think it's a point that's not really being covered in the U.S. media circles, but I thought it was really interesting. And it's true, actually. I looked it up before and after our interview. Of the, let's say, roughly $183 billion that is going to Ukraine, first of all, not all of it is military aid. A lot of it's aid to support like Ukrainian businesses and humanitarian projects and things like this. But he said less than half of that money has actually made it to Ukraine, that there are billions of dollars that are not going directly to the battlefield to support his troops, but they're going to other initiatives and to these things that are sort of linked to Ukraine, but not directly Ukrainian soldiers, which is really interesting. And it makes a lot of sense, because when you think about all of these budget deals that we hear about in Washington that get passed, Washington is infamous for having an infinite amount of line items to random things that money will go to. It never is really clear cut when money is moving from one place to another. Everyone's getting sort of their take, and maybe someone puts in a line for a few million dollars for a local Ukrainian charity in their state so that they can go to their constituents and say, hey, look, this is what I did. But the bottom line here is that he wanted to make a point that not all of those billions of dollars are actually making it to the soldiers on the front lines, and those that are going toward weapons, in some cases, that they're not even allowed to fully use yet.
It's crazy. Let me ask you something. Have you seen this victory plan that he talked about? I only have a minute left. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I researched it a little bit. I think that it is a negotiating standpoint for the Ukrainians. It's not realistic. It's something that will be accepted. But I understand why they put it out, because they're going into the negotiations eventually, and they want to at least have something on the table that expresses their interests.
Trey Yank says nowhere he won't go for a big story and a big interview, and he did it again with President Zelensky. Pick up his book, Black Saturday. Trey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Gomez.
And stay safe. We're going to come back, take your calls, and also update you on even more people entering the Trump cabinet. Don't move.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There's been some talk about using other states' National Guard, red state National Guards, to somehow come into a blue state and try and enforce these new Stephen Miller-inspired rules. And that's just not something we're going to accept.
Yeah, it's Stephen Miller-inspired. Yeah, it's cracking down on criminals. It's cracking down on criminals who are here illegally, and the 1.4 million have overstayed their visas or have committed crimes, and they've been allowed to run rampant through the country. If you are going to stand in the way, it's not Stephen Miller. You're standing in the way of the people of Chicago. Bruce in Pennsylvania. Hey, Bruce.
Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I got three quick points. Point number one, Russia got the idea of cutting those lines because of the gas lines that were cut a couple years ago. So that's a no-brainer. I'm surprised they didn't do it within a month or two after the gas line was cut. That's point number one. And point number two, there was a bill passed by Congress last year, which Chuck Schumer refused to take up. It was about voting, ID voting, and better voting in the United States. I think it needs to be taken up again this year.
Real quick,
we'll have
the third
Senate.
One. Third one.
And the third one, and the most important one, is, you know, the Democrats, they don't give a damn about personality. I don't care. I'll tell you, if Jeff Sessions was up right now.
Thanks for the call.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Elections have consequences, and the federal government is responsible for a certain set of actions, and cities, no individual city can reverse or override some parts of that. But what we can do is make sure that we are doing our part to protect our residents in every possible way, that we are not cooperating with those efforts that actually threaten the safety of everyone by causing widespread fear and having large-scale economic impact. And then we are providing the spaces to reach out directly to our residents, because the last thing we want is for people who are part of our economy, part of our school system, part of our community and the fabric of our city to feel that all of a sudden they have to retreat into the shadows because of fear that reaching out to city services, whether it's calling 911 when you need it or taking your child to school, those are all city services that have nothing to do with immigration enforcement.
Yeah, right. So you're here illegally. You broke the law by crossing illegally, overstaying your visa, but it has nothing to do with law enforcement. Number two is, which Tom Homan's focused on initially, is going to be the criminals amongst us, the Venezuelan gang members located in 16 states. And you're going to say that you don't cooperate with ICE. What do you think ICE does? They go to maybe raid a landscaper truck? Do you think they're storming into kitchens in your local restaurant? Or do you think they're trying to grab criminals before they kill, like the one we just had, who was just convicted moments ago, Ibarra, of killing Lake and Riley in cold blood? The same one that came here as a member of a Venezuelan crime unit, gang, who was at the Roosevelt Hotel, 6 blocks from this studio, and then took a free flight offered by New York City to get them off our city because we had 237,000 come through here over the last 3.5 years, now 4, and then he goes to Georgia and kills Lake and Riley. If it's up to that mayor, the mayor of Los Angeles, the mayor of Boston, who you just heard, I wouldn't say mayor of New York because I'm not sure, the mayor of Philadelphia, it's up. You let them alone. And if ICE wants to pick them up, I'm not going to cooperate. I'm not going to answer the detainer request. That's how sickening it is. So with me now to talk about that, but also about what the president's situation is right now, the future president, is Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, I'm just amazed at the standoff that we're going to be talking to you about a lot more when President Trump takes over, and that's the sanctuary cities of Boston, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Chicago, and the criminals there that are going to be protected by these mayors who are under the mistaken impression that shows tolerance.
Yeah, there's going to be some interesting legal issues that arise very, very quickly. It's not unlike what happened in the first Trump term, when not only Democratic cities moved against Trump, but even the acting attorney general ordered people at the Department of Justice not to assist the new president in his immigration policies, a move that I criticized at the time, in my view, as deeply unprofessional and likely unethical. And so you're going to have a repeat of that, but this is a little bit different. You know, there are federal laws that make it a crime to harbor individuals that are being sought by ICE and the federal government. Now, what these cities are going to argue is that they're not going to obstruct, but they're not going to assist. And that is, as you note, a rather curious position, because immigration really propelled this election, and it was an issue that resonated with both Republicans and Democrats. They were overwhelmingly in favor of deporting people who are here unlawfully. And so it's a very interesting issue, not just legally, but politically, because you have these Democratic cities doubling down on the very issue that brought them this electoral defeat.
Jonathan Turley, our guest. Jonathan, so people don't know, Jose Ibarra has just been convicted of the murder of Lake and Riley. We had everything except the actual videotape of the murder taking place. It's an overwhelming amount of evidence. For some reason, he rejected a jury trial. So a judge has judges found him guilty. And will they sentence him right now?
Usually the sentencing is delayed for the probation office to issue a report. The judge also hears from the defense counsel in terms of the guidelines on sentencing, et cetera. On this case, there's not going to be a lot of debate. This is a horrific crime. It's going to go to the top of any sentencing option. But usually the judge will give time to have the parties file their recommendations and also to hear from the PO.
Right. I mean, it's unbelievable. He just sits there and listens to all this, and we heard all the – it was just overwhelming. Tom Homan talked about this, and when he says, when we talk about sanctuary cities and their effort to protect criminals that ICE wants to scoop up. Cut 9.
Well, if they want to help us get the hell out of the way, we're going to do it. If I got to send twice the amount of resources to that city, that's what we're going to do. If they would give us access to the jail, that would mean less agents in the community. For them pushing back and not letting us in the jail, it just means more agents are going to be in the community, so they're hurting themselves. Finally, I'll say this. They need to educate themselves. They need to review this. Title 8, United States Code, 1324, triple I. Read about that and don't cross that line, because it is a felony to harbor and conceal an illegal alien from ICE. Read the statute. Don't cross that line.
Can you expand? I mean, I don't expect you to memorize every statute in the law, but do you know what he's talking about?
Yes, that is the very law I referred to earlier, that it is a crime to interfere or obstruct the federal government on arresting and transporting persons under the immigration laws and other laws. And so this is not the guy you want to mess with. Holman knows the law. He has been writing and talking about this for years. He knows exactly what he's going to do. One of the things that the cities need to be aware of is that I don't expect Congress is going to take this lying down. You know, the American people gave a very strong mandate, not just to President-elect Trump, but to Congress on specifically immigration. I mean, you can debate how much of a mandate goes here or there, but there should be no debate, judging from all of the polling, that the public wants to deal with immigration, including deportations. And what the Congress can do is to tell these cities, with the support of President Trump, if you don't assist us, then why are we going to assist you in other areas? We will withhold the funding under justice programs, under immigration programs, under a number of federal programs that you rely upon. So this isn't a one-way street. Nice. If you tell us to go pound sand, we're going to do the same thing when you come to us for federal funding.
A lot of these police chiefs agree with Tom Holman, but they have to go by, I guess, the mayor of their city. And if they say yesterday the city council in Los Angeles passed a rule 13-0 to keep it sanctuary city status, it's already a sanctuary state status, but 13-0. I mean, when we see the death of Lakin Riley and see these stories and find out that this guy was wanted anyway, and they don't understand the disconnect, we're not trying to raid anyone's kitchen. We're not trying to take someone out of the cornfields. We're trying to take them out of gangs. We're trying to take them off the police blotter. We're trying to get them out of jails and sending them out of the country. What's the don't people understand that that the idealistic approach to sanctuary cities has long passed?
You know, this is why Las Vegas is such a profitable city. You know, you have gamblers that will sit there with a losing hand, and instead of folding, they will double down. And these Democrats are doubling and tripling down on an issue that they have lost even their base on. Many Democrats did not support them on immigration. And, you know, obviously cities like L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, those are the very core Democratic liberal base. But they've always done stuff like this. You know, this is part of the whole shtick, you know, to say that I'm a champion here. And you've got like the governor of Illinois saying, you know, having this sort of diehard moment that, you know, they'll have to go through me. Well, they really don't have to go through you, right? It's the federal government. So Holman's right about this. You got to be pretty darn careful if you're the governor of Illinois, because you know, you really are not a sovereign unto yourself in the sense that you can obstruct federal law. So they have the right to go and get these people. And so the degree to which these cities, these states obstruct the Trump administration, there may indeed be legal consequences, but I expect there's also going to be financial consequences. And these are cities, I'm from Chicago, and the impact of unlawful immigration in Chicago is immense. I mean, where my mother lives, there's tent camps all the way running along the park. You go there, and there's people that, you know, that sit out. There's even a barber shop that is sort of impromptu barber shop set up there. And many people in Chicago are saying, for the love of God, are we going to get a handle on this or what?
I know.
But you have these politicians that are largely elected in primaries by that 30% of the Democratic base that is just off the charts on this issue.
I hear you. Hopefully it'll change if the Republicans keep making these cities compete for the vote. So I want to ask you about the cover of the New York Post today, and it says, let him loose, Bragg. Won't let Trump go. He's thinking about delaying the sentence. This judge is thinking about delaying the sentencing to Trump, and maybe just holding off until he's done with being president at the age of 82. What could you tell us about what the judge didn't do yesterday?
Well, what I said in that column is that of all the options available to the judge, this is hands down the worst one, that Bragg is saying, hold this in abeyance. Let this thing just stay pending for what would be 5 years. And then in 2029, when he's done as president, you and I can come back and we can sentence him to jail if we want to. It's an absolutely appalling idea. But Bragg is pushing that with Judge Mershon. And for people in New York, it's really ideal, right? Because if they sentence Trump right now, it's almost impossible that he's going to get jail time. And putting aside that he's going to be president, it would be unlikely even without that. So, you know, in many ways, it would be a buzzkill if he ended up coming out with, for these New York Democrats, come out with a fine, or if the judge declares the presidency a form of community service. You know, so the best thing for many people in New York is to make him this type of conditional president, this president with an asterisk that says pending sentencing. It's ideal for them. And in the meantime, it also interferes with his ability to appeal a lot of these issues. You know, I think that the best thing for Trump is to have him go ahead and make his decision. There are grounds here to dismiss the case, but even if he doesn't, this case has layers of reversible error. Mershon made an unholy mess of this case. It should never have been brought, and I don't think it would be able to withstand a full appeal. It might make it through the first appeal, but I'd be surprised if it could stand up. I think that we need to get on with it. But the idea that you're going to have a president by layaway where he's just going to be tagged on the shelf for 2029 is something that I find absolutely grotesque.
Me too. Danny Penny fighting for his freedom. He's looking at 20 years for manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, for being a hero, in my view, on a subway train. And you had a Marine officer come out and talk about what a fantastic Marine he was, condemnation. He got all types of medals for being outstanding humanitarian and as well as a war fighter. And then you find all these eyewitnesses say they were fearing for their lives. Your thoughts about his fate from what you know?
Well, once again, it's like New York is a parallel universe. You know, I felt this way with the Trump case, where I was sat in that courtroom and I was just in disbelief with how the judge was ruling and how this absurd case could have ever gotten to trial. I have the same feeling with Penny. I mean, the cops on the ground did not think that this was a crime. That's abundantly obvious. And prosecutors are supposed to use some discretion here. And I think from the facts of the case, and these have certainly been magnified at trial, this was someone who was trying to protect others. Now, it's true that sometimes people protecting others might go too far. Maybe they're what they thought was a restraint was endangering someone to a greater degree. But the fact is, his motivation was to protect others. He was doing what he was trained to do as a Marine. And this case should never have been brought. And particularly in New York, where you have the release of people left and right who are accused of these heinous crimes, and you've got Bragg and others who are downgrading crimes, it's truly like we're in a parallel universe. Like, this is a bad joke. I mean, I just don't see how a prosecutor looking at these facts felt that it was necessary to go forward with charges.
I know. And the more you hear about the case, the more it backs it up, in my view. Jonathan Turley, thanks so much. Of course, the breaking news, Abara found guilty. We'll find out his sentence for the death of Lake and Riley. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. I got to find out if there's more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
So Netflix subscribers are suing the company for breach of contract over the terrible quality of the Mike Tyson fight. I agree. I had two TVs froze. The other one was able, the small one in my kitchen, I was able to use. They got 65 million people tune in, and it was just a disaster. Why? Maybe they're not ready for the capacity. I have news for you. Got its Christmas games, the NFL. You better straighten it out, Netflix. And by the way, Mike Tyson, you should have fought. It's so obvious you didn't try, and I feel like I wasted my entire night when I could have been dancing at the clubs like I normally do. Next, Oliver McCall, former heavyweight champion, returning to the ring at 59 years old. He wasn't normal in his prime. He won't be normal again. Tyson's not the only one who's going to be fighting as a former champion. He last fought in 2019. He'll face Stacy Frazier, who's 54. What is going on? Next, 37% of respondents to a Pew Research Center study between the ages of 18 to 29 say they get their news from influencers. Hey, guys, wise up. Ladies, they're paid to influence you. They're not giving you the news. They're giving you the news from people who are paying them to give you the news. That's nearly 21% of all Americans. That is scary. Next, having too many pictures and unread emails on your phone might mean you have a hoarding disorder. I'm guilty, and I guess I need some treatment. It is often associated with obsessive compulsive, is believed to affect about 2.5% of Americans. There are also hoarders by instruction who keep data on behalf of their company, anxious hoarders who emotionally preserve information they need later. There are just collectors who have well-organized system on files. I'm somewhere in between.
What about lazy hoarders? Because sometimes you have a bunch and just too lazy to go in and delete them, not keeping them for any special right. reason.
That is something that you blame your parents for. And you use, I guess, Ritalin. Next, an egg a day could keep cognitive decline away. A team of University of California San Diego people discovered the older women who eat eggs each day may experience less memory loss. This is impossible. I have some memory loss. Had I not eaten eggs, it would be totally lost.
Hey, if you did it for a number of years, once a day, especially for women, it helps them.
I'm just trying to think. Did the people who bring you eggs actually commission this study? I have to look into that. And next, seven British singers in music history, according to fans and music experts. Here are the best singers. Number seven is Paul McCartney. Number six is John Lennon. Five, Amy Winehouse. Four, Adele. Three, Freddie Mercury. Two, Elton John. Number one, David Bowie. Distinctive, but the best? You make the call, you're from that country. Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. This week, I'm joined by retired San Francisco police captain Yolanda Williams as she details her escape from the People's Temple cult. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.